It's really about keeping our communities safe, and the president's committed to do that. Some of the unrest that we saw even in the last month or so, but particularly last night and in the week leading up to it in Portland, it's just not acceptable when you look at communities not being safe and not upholding the rule of law. So yeah. Attorney General Barr is weighing in on that with Secretary Wolf, and you'll see something rolled out this week as we start to go in and make sure that the communities, whether it's Chicago or Portland or Milwaukee or someplace across the heartland of the country, we need to make sure that our communities are safe.
That was White House Chief of Staff and former head of the House Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows, talking on Fox News Sunday about the Trump administration sending federal law enforcement into the street conflicts of Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere, including unidentified cops who, in at least one case, snatched a protester off the street and drove him away in an unmarked vehicle. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my geographically disparate colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
So it looks like we didn't need the Insurrection Act after all. That's a deep cut for those of you who don't remember 6 weeks ago, which means the entire world. A whole bunch of weird things kicked into motion when the Insurrection Act was invoked by Senator Tom Cotton in an op-ed in the New York Times. He was arguing back when there were more protests and riots and whatnot in the streets, looting, that the federal government should invoke that as it did during the LA riots of 1990, whatever, to bring order to cities that weren't having order. Well, what we have found over the past week is that you don't need that. That legal justification is not strictly required when the executive branch decides it wants to get into some enforcements, as has been taking place in Oregon more or less the last week of federal cracking down on protests that have been going on for nearly 2 months. So it's the Border Patrol Tactical Unit that is currently executing the Trump administration's enforcement priorities more than 500 miles from the nearest international border. So, Catherine, Reason was against the formation of the Department of Homeland Security from the get-go. We've been talking for literally decades about how immigration enforcement activities inevitably ends up cramping the liberties of U.S. citizens. And generally, we're the annoying people talking about mission creep of various federal agencies. And yet, Catherine Mangue Ward, over the weekend, somebody named Brian Schatz, who I think is a U.S. senator, which I didn't know until I saw this thing going around Twitter. The word libertarian was trending this weekend on Twitter because Senator Brian Schatz and then a bunch of other people wearing clown pants were basically saying, "Where you at, libertarians? I don't hear anything about you and talking about Portland." So what say you, editrix of Reason, about libertarians being on the sidelines about these law enforcement issues and the federal government?
Well, I guess we are on the sidelines in the sense that we are standing on the sidelines screaming as loud as we can that everything is really, really bad and this has to stop. Because as we have discussed many, many times on this podcast, libertarians don't have very much political power. So in that sense, yes, we are on the sidelines. In all other senses, we have been all over this. And I find it wild, frankly, that people would look at the current landscape and be like, you know what we're going to do? Blame libertarians for this. But I have been finding that wild for at least the last couple of years. There is this thing going on where it's like libertarians have been in charge for too long. And now we have to, A, go back to having trade wars, B, go back to having virtue in the public square, and apparently now C, go back to opposing massive federal bureaucracies. Like, I don't know what people think we're up to, but, you know, in some ways I blame myself, Matt. In some ways I do, because the fact that people are just still so far from comprehending our business and our agenda at this point in the game, you know, that's on us, at least in part. But yes, to be extremely clear, I think this is absolutely the heart of libertarianism to say unidentified or poorly identified federal agents who are ostensibly part of border enforcement in the interior of the country, taking people off of the streets as they engage in political protest. That's the thing we're against. That thing right there. That's our main thing that we're against. And the thing that keeps cracking me up, and then I'll let other people get in here and share their outrage too, is they keep mentioning graffiti like as one of the main thing. It's like, well, they're doing the graffiti on federal buildings. It's like, no, that is not a good enough reason, my friend. Absolutely not. Like, don't say the word graffiti anywhere in your justification of this heinous act. So that's my one coda there.
Peter, let's give the cracker downers, the enthusiasts for federal intervention here, their argumentative due, which would go something like this. Portland, Oregon has for the last 3 years been kind of an ongoing, you know, people in not very good physical shape engaging in pitched street battles with one another, with Antifa on one side and the Proud Boys on the other, and various boogaloos thrown in, depending. And the local city government has largely, although I'm sure some people will object to this following characterization, has largely sat on its hands, right? So there's like, you know, kind of looking the other way as people punch each other in the street. So doesn't the federal government have the right to defend its own property, in this case, a federal courthouse, where people have been like trying to light fires on a federal courthouse when there's people inside? Like, isn't that a textbook example of when you do send in the federal cops, Peter Suderman?
The federal government does have the legal right to defend the federal courthouse itself. And if people are throwing Molotov cocktails at the federal courthouse, that seems like a reasonable time to have the Federal Protective Service that normally operates at that courthouse and that normally defends that courthouse take some action to defend the property of the federal government that they have been tasked with defending. The problem, as Catherine said, is that it's not just the Federal Protective Service here. The Federal Protective Service has called in CBP and ICE agents, including, as you mentioned, the kind of Border Patrol SWAT team known as BORTAC, which is great federal acronym here.
So sinister.
Which usually investigates drug smuggling operations and sort of big kind of crime cartels and things like that. And what they've done is they've called in federal border SWAT teams and then given them jurisdiction not just over the courthouse itself, but over a very large area of land that surrounds the courthouse and isn't federal at all. And so the pretext for this is we're guarding federal property. But that has just become a justification for expanding federal police activities, often, as we have already mentioned, by people who at least their names have been covered. And the people involved, the law enforcement agencies, have said, yes, we are covering our names. You cannot see who we are. They do say that they are marking themselves as federal agents, although there are reports from protesters that say that that's not true, that they're just kind of out there in camouflage and military-ish gear, snatching people up off the streets and sort of taking actions. But they've allowed this idea that they have allowed their job, which is protect the courthouse, to become an excuse for citywide, basically secret police operations that are pretty clearly an extension of Trump's 2020 presidential campaign. I mean, you heard Mark Meadows there talk about how this might be being expanded into other cities. There are other folks who have been involved with this are saying the same thing, including Ken Cuccinelli, who runs the Department of Homeland Security. CBS News is reporting just this morning that the Trump administration plans to send more than 170 federal officers to a bunch of different cities around the country to assist local police with what they call unrest. Trump is waging a sort of secret police war on protesters in Democratic cities, and all of these officers are going to Democratic cities, not to Republican-controlled cities. And this is going to be what he runs his campaign on.
Nick, there's a quote from this morning from DHS Acting Secretary Chad Wolf, which is the world's best name, saying, "I don't need invitations by the state mayors or state governors to do our job," unquote. We're going to do, or actually further quote, we're going to do that whether they like us there or not. Let's get to a little, just a sliver of principle, which is that the Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, and whatnot is allowed to enforce immigration law within 100 miles of borders. And of course, that includes the border of the ocean. This is the way that Portland, Oregon is within that zone. There are various maps that you can see online that Reason is published in the magazine and online too, where around 2/3 of the U.S. population is therefore within that border. And they could do things like have these checkpoints. And just if you're driving through, pull you over and say, "Are you a U.S. citizen? Papers, please," kind of thing. On the narrow principle, should the federal government, in the guise of law enforcement, be able to have free hand to conduct law enforcement, including checkpoints, within 100 miles or within 50 miles or within 25 miles? What's your sense of what should be the latitude?
Well, you know, Matt, as a libertarian, of course, I'm only interested in, you know, figuring out the optimal rate of the long-term and short-term capital gains tax rate. So all of this is, you know, clearly a minor issue that
that's
going to really
be the next topic,
anything,
right?
But
always the
I
second
so.
Topic on the
I
pod.
I mean, for the rest of the year. I mean, I don't know why the election isn't hinging on that, particularly for libertarians who are calling all the shots. No, I don't, you know, I think we have gone so off the rails in terms of immigration control. The federal government and no law enforcement agency should ever have a free hand to do anything. I mean, the whole point of the rule of law, which is typically invoked by conservatives and people who call themselves constitutionalists, who may also find themselves defending some of the policies of the Trump administration, it's got to be rule-bound. It's got to be have judicial oversight. It has to be hemmed in very clear ways. And I find, you know, these kinds of moments, I don't think that this is going to become the big issue. And I don't think that Donald Trump is going to suddenly, you know, flip a switch and take over, you know, the administration of, you know, 100 of the 100 largest democratically controlled cities in America or anything. But this should be deeply troubling because it's more of an indication of a general disinterest in the process of governing. And I don't think it's simply Donald Trump. I think we are getting towards, you know, hopefully the bottom of a trend over the past 20 years, I like to just keep it in the 21st century, of getting rid of process in all sorts of ways because it gets in the way and it slows things down. So I hope that answers your question, Matt Welch. For me, the whole point of having a free society is that you do have immigration checkpoints at the borders. And then once you've made it through, once you've entered the country, you should have the maximal amount of freedom where you don't have to show papers. You don't have to explain yourself. The idea is that once you're in and you're free.
I do kind of love Trump telling Fox News over the weekend that he supported, you know, the federal actions in Portland because anarchists were taking over and, quote, if we're going to lose Portland, like the city is just going to be demolished or sort of fall off the map. I mean, like escape from Los Angeles, escape from New York style. Like the whole city is just, I mean, there is a 12 block radius in which there has been some unrest. There has been stuff that I think you could plausibly call rioting at small scale, especially over the weekend. But that has gotten worse since the federal agents entered the scene. And it may well be that the Democratic mayor is not doing a great job of controlling the protesters and stopping property violence. That may be the case, but it doesn't seem to be.
I don't think they are.
There's no evidence. In fact, there's the opposite of evidence that the federal agents are making the situation any better.
Yeah, you know, one of the, I read an account in the Washington Post by a protester who claims to have been detained for a while and then set free. And he said, "I feel like I'm in a Philip K. Dick novel. I feel like this is more of a Robert Anton Wilson play out of the Illuminatus trilogy, where we are moving into a world where everybody wins when everybody acts as poorly as they possibly can. And so when Donald Trump goes overboard and zealous, when the federal government and the Border Patrol goes nuts, when protesters act terribly and, and commit violent crime or property crime, everybody wins because you have a complete melee and mayhem. And that seems to be what people want. Very few people want to get to a place where we're actually talking about differences and grievances in a kind of rational way that might actually lead towards some kind of resolution. It's really about keeping
the panic going. I also just want to note the incompetence level is so high. I mean, Peter rightly pointed out the presence of federal agents has not had a calming effect. It has had the opposite. It has not had a pacifying effect, although that word pacifying is to be used advisedly. It has had the opposite. The same thing happened in Lafayette Park in D.C. when all of a sudden there were a bunch of people in paramilitary gear without clear IDs. And in D.C., we're kind of used to that garbage, to be quite honest, because we're not a state anyway. And who cares? We don't really have rights. But even in D.C., we were like, hold
especially
on.
Especially the closer you get to the White House.
Right, exactly.
It's not like, even like that there's like particular, you know, specifically marked zones. It's just that the heat map of your rights, like
you evaporates
just lose them
the closer you
the
get.
Further you, the closer you to get the to the White House.
That's or, correct.
Yeah.
So like, but even in D.C., people had like a very negative response to the presence of those troops. And again, they didn't do a good job, right? They in fact, were not correctly trained for this work. They did not know how to behave in that environment and they screwed up. In Portland, the best
detail.
And it detail,
also happened because the administration was supposed to do it earlier in the afternoon and they just kind of forgot to move the protesters out of the way of their planned photo op.
Right. So
the
that,
whole thing
that
was
incompetence
just
detail is
an
great.
An incredible shit show of lack of ability to do anything competently.
Let her finish her point.
The other detail, though, is that in Portland, one of the reasons that we all wound up paying attention to these quote unquote kidnappings is because they grabbed the wrong person. In the very, very beginning of this, when everybody was like, hold on, what are those vans? What's going on? They grabbed the wrong person, took them to what they later discovered was a federal courthouse rather than a county jail, said like, oh, I'm sorry, who are you again? And then let them go. And that person, of course, immediately walked out into the street and was like, you guys, you are not going to believe. Just like, if you're going to do this, if you're going to be like, we are elite federal agents defending federal property for reasons of important national security, don't immediately grab the wrong idiot off of a protest and then immediately pretend like this was the, you know, this is the plan all along and it's vital to national security.
This is exactly the plot of Brazil, by the way, which starts with a bunch of state agents taking into custody the wrong guy because a fly got into the typewriter machine and changed Tuttle to Buttle, or maybe it was Buttle to Tuttle. And then they broke into the wrong Uttle's house and took him in front of his family. Like they like just like it's this huge sort of SWAT operation and they like come in through the ceiling and mess up the apartment above. And then, of course, they've got like guys who come in and like try to replace the little circle that they drilled, that they cut out in the floor of the apartment above. And it's the wrong size because every single thing that they do is wrong and incompetent.
Not to pick a fight, but I totally hate Brazil. I think that movie is super terrible.
What are they protesting in Portland at this point, by the way?
Well, at this point, they're actually protesting the presence of federal police. And this is a big thing. The chants over the past couple of days have become specifically about how these are whose streets, our streets. There's like a moms group that's like federal agents get out
or
something.
The wall of moms.
Like
the wall of moms.
Mothers against federal. I don't know. Mothers against something against the federal government. Catherine, you could join that.
Mothers Against Invention.
I prefer the wall of death to the wall of moms. This brings your question, Nick, actually brings to mind an issue, a possible issue. Maybe it's not. But You in particular, Nick, have supported over the years or sort of celebrated the decentralization of media that goes out there and the ability of people to record things on their phones. Peter has written also about how that has affected views of criminal justice reform and police abuse over the just that affects, you know, the George Floyd protests, which is the original like progenitor of these particular protests. Although, as I said before, people have been barking at each other in Portland for the last 3 years. And, you know, doing some reading around this, and granted, I'm not doing it in any thoroughgoing way, but seeing all this video and seeing like this side puts up a video with, you know, this kind of most extreme interpretation, and then that side puts up this video with the most extreme interpretation, it's kind of hard to find and to figure out how to find trustworthy journalism on this. Is it
I listen to Nick Cannon podcasts for my deep analysis of the current moment. It's not a trivial point, and it's I've been talking with various people who were kind of my spirit animals and spirit guides in celebrating, you know, the radical decentralization and the empowerment of individuals to kind of speak their truths and represent their truths. Which I'm still totally in favor of, but it does, you know, it, and I know Peter has written about this, it forces a media literacy on us that I don't think we've taken fully seriously yet. It becomes hard, you know, to know what are trusted sources and what are not. And this is one of the things where I think we're seeing in cable media a meltdown of, you know, Fox, MSNBC, to some degree CNN. They have lost the trust and confidence that they might have once had among viewers, and it's part of a continuing process. And I don't know where that lands. I think, you know, it's incumbent upon you know, outlets like Reason and other places to, you know, kind of both be upfront about your biases and your proclivities, but then also deliver the goods in terms of a defensible vision of reality. And that obviously gets harder and harder when you have, you know, 20-second clips circulating on Twitter detached from any clear origin. I keep meaning to do a deep read and reanalysis of Walter Benjamin's The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, a 1930 essay, by most accounts, one of the most widely cited essays in the 20th century. And he frets over the rise of mass media and its propagandistic potential, because you can take things out of their original socio-historical economic context and put them to whatever use you want. We're living in a hyper version of that, and it's both liberating and very confusing.
Catherine, before we leave the topic, I wanted to float with you a thing that was rattling around my head this weekend when seeing the hashtag libertarians and where are you all at, and then seeing lots of people in our universe saying, oh no, we've been here all along, look at this, and here are these people that are good, and it's your fault for not knowing, and this kind of stuff. And I had the kind of an opposite instinct in the moment, not that I acted on it in any way, shape, or form, because it's 1,000 degrees and I have kids. But like, when people engage in such basically dishonest, at best ignorance, at most, or at least sort of like a trolling or whatever. I don't know at best or at least. But anyways, when they say things that are just untrue, that reflect their own ignorance about what libertarians have been talking about, and they're doing it in a way actually to try to kind of push people into joining this tribe or that tribe, my feeling right now is like, go do something untoward to yourself.
Careful there,
that's
buddy.
Pretty strong language, Matt Welch.
Listen, somebody around here has got to keep the line about trying to keep this a PG-13 sometimes on this podcast. But like, I don't feel the necessity to kind of throat clear and show my bona fides, or however you pronounce it, Nick, on any of this anymore. I don't know why this has struck me so strong the last couple of months in particular, but it has. Like, you know, if you are going to make an ignorant general statement about libertarians, and particularly if you're going to do this as a, you know, a recent ex-libertarian, which a lot of people appear to enjoy doing, have fun. But like, that's not my problem. That is your problem. If Brian Schatz is going to schatz on the world of libertarianism, that's totally his problem and not my problem. Then that's the memo. Catherine, please react to my my bad language.
I disagree. I guess I think, you know, my approach to basically all things in life, but especially this, is relentless, calm politeness. And to just be like, hey, thanks for your thoughts. You might want to check out these links is the way to do the thing pretty much all the time.
You've been trained well.
Always be
closing, man.
Cab is also always be closing.
Always be hydrating.
Always be hydrating. I just want to, yeah.
I always think of ACAB as like a Genesis
record. It's all coming together.
Abacab.
Abba is another option. Yeah. I think
are bad.
It's perfectly, you know, it's perfectly fine for people to not fully understand libertarianism because it's a minority viewpoint that not everyone understands. And I think all of us are a little triggered when people get confused and think we're just conservatives who like to smoke weed, because boy howdy, have we all heard that a lot of times. But it's the only way that's going to change is if you just keep being like, thanks for your thoughts. Here are some links. And so that's what I do.
You're a nice person.
I am.
God love you, Catherine. All right, let's switch up here to
Matt. You are sounding eerily like Joe Biden.
I was a Joe Biden impersonation, referencing real American genius, real man of genius.
Catherine Mangu Ward is like the Esther Williams of libertarianism.
I think she's like the Terminator of libertarianism. You know?
She's the Betty Grable. She's got her links start at her hips and go all the way to the floor.
She can't be bargained with.
Let's leave it at that.
She can't be reasoned with. She doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear. And she absolutely will not stop ever until you understand the basic arguments of libertarianism.
Do you know who else won't stop, Peter?
It is.
Go on, Nick.
Oh, I would. Well, I'm sorry to have stepped on your won't stop.
Can't stop, won't stop.
But, you know, look, people are reaching towards libertarianism and smacking it down because they are desperate for an alternative. And we know that the alternative of conservatism and liberalism or progressivism, these are, you know, they're stuck pigs and they are dying. And libertarianism, of course, people want to blame libertarians for everything. I'm happy to take that responsibility. And then, as Catherine says, point people towards stuff we've been doing or, you know, what are we thinking about? And I don't know if you're worried, you know, and at various points, conservatives, not in, in recent memory, conservatives were worried about what was the name of the thing, the Jade Helm conspiracy in Texas,
man.
And black helicopters up in Montana and
don't
Idaho.
Don't forget
and
the trans, what was
yeah,
it?
The trans North American Highway or Trans American Highway or
super
something,
high.
Which somehow
high.
Would take go from Mexico to Canada. Yeah, super highway where you wouldn't even have to stop in America, and somehow this was a bad thing because Mexicans wouldn't be getting off in America at you know Stuckey's and rest stops or something, but. You know, we have a pretty good answer to all of the bad stuff that's happening now. You know, so let's run.
Peter, so let's switch to coronavirus, since feels like everyone is re-losing their minds on this issue right now. You have incidents of both test cases and or positive cases in particular, but also now deaths are moving up in many parts of the country. The president, as Peter had mentioned before, gave a pretty interesting or telling interview with Chris Wallace on Fox on Sunday, in which he apparently seemed to be confused about the mortality rate, among other things. Peter, I didn't necessarily prepare you for this, but I know that it's just inside your computerman shell of a brain to be able to say this. Can you kind of give us an overview of what the hell is going on with the coronavirus in this country? And you can focus on whatever little tidbit you want, whether it's the Trump bit or anything else. But like from your perspective, coronavirus response and what the hell is happening right now?
Well, there are about 3.8 million cases confirmed in the United States so far, about 143,000 confirmed deaths. A large number, not a majority, but a large number of those deaths are linked to nursing homes. And I think, you know, sort of something we should probably talk about is that that appears to be true not just nationally, but in Texas as well. And so we have talked for a long time on this podcast about how people should judge their, you know, as much as possible, we want people to be making their own choices about individual risk. And that is certainly, I think, the ideal. But what we're seeing in Texas is that as the economy has reopened, younger people have gone out and gone back to work, which I think is certainly a good, been able to go out and socialize, which is something that we would all like to be able to do, go to bars, things like that. We would like that to be able to happen, but they haven't been able to contain the virus to young people. And so we've seen about 40% of the deaths in Texas, which is registering death counts in the hundreds each day. And so some of those are coming in on a delayed basis. It's not necessarily the case that those death counts are, oh, if we get the count on Saturday, that's what happened on Saturday. But they do represent, if you look at the 7-day rolling average, we're seeing very, very high death counts in Texas. And so there's this sort of there is this question about how to handle a virus where when people make choices for themselves, they're also making choices that end up impacting other people, in some cases, elderly people who have few options to protect themselves. And so that is, you know, I think that's one of the ways we can talk about the argument about the policy response in particular masks right now. And so there are mask orders in a bunch of states right now. Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, who is a Republican, is suing the Democratic mayor of Atlanta because the mayor of Atlanta put a mask order in place. But even in conservative states, you see like Arkansas, Texas, you're starting to see Republican administrations say, we've got to have mandatory mask wearing, at least in public places where social distancing is basically not possible. And the reason we've got to do that is that it is an alternative to shutting the economy back down again, which is what's happened in California. And as we've seen, as we've talked about in previous weeks, Florida and Texas have at least paused their reopenings because of these, because of surging case numbers and eventually surging deaths. And so, you know, a big part of the argument is about masks, which are the case for masks is not so much that they help you, but that if everyone is wearing a mask, that helps everyone else. And so you're sort of doing your part socially. And then, you know, and then we have President Trump, who gave just an astounding interview over the weekend to Fox News's Chris Wallace. We talked about Fox News a little while ago. And like, this is one of the values of Fox News, is they can get President Trump on for an extended interview in which they ask him hard questions and he proves unable to answer them. And Trump is still saying, you know, I've been saying it's going away. Eventually, it's going away. Guys, it's not going away. Just like Catherine Mangy Ward, just like the Terminator, it's out there. It's coming for us. It can't be stopped.
Wow. Catherine, you're not going away. So the rumors that I've been circulating are not true?
Unfortunately, no.
There are, speaking of rumors, discussion.
Wait, can I ask, just as a clarifying case then, or a question for everybody. So are we for or against mandatory masking in public? And how is that distinct from, say, vaccinations? Matt Welch, the interrogator, is now the interrogated. Are you in favor of mandatory masking in public?
I am not in favor of the police writing me a ticket if I'm not wearing a mask outside. No. If the government wants to give guidelines about certain buildings that you can't walk into without a mask, totally fine. With that, depending on what types of buildings and what authority there is.
Does Brian Kemp, as a governor, have the right to tell local jurisdictions that they can't have mandatory mask laws? And I'm asking this kind of, I'm not just trying to pick fights. I am curious because it seems that I could conceivably argue this from various positions well within the kind of libertarian
I'll toss this to Catherine with in this way. Our own Christian Britsky. I don't know how to pronounce his damn name. Why don't we get some people with pronounceable names? Was this NPR? Christian wrote...
Wow, Matt Welch, I think you're going
to
be canceled.
I've been trying to for a long time, Nick. Christian said, like, good. Good on Brian Kemp for doing this. Justin Amash, the only elected libertarian congressman ever, and soon to be the last, mentioned that that's not a proper role of a governor. Let localities decide themselves. So, Catherine, given that spectrum of opinion, where do you lie?
I, as always, want to devolve this as locally as possible, and I think, you know, I think that for just as it is troubling for, you know, the federal government in whatever manifestation to tell states what their dictates should be internally, I think it is troubling for states to tell localities. I think that coronavirus is a national phenomenon, but it is playing out very differently in different places, and that it is ridiculous to try and make a single standard for the entire nation. There are plenty of places, like, for instance, where Jerry Tuchilli lives, where saying you must wear a mask outdoors is just flat out absurd. If you are walking alone among the rattlesnakes, you don't need a mask. And Donald Trump doesn't know or not know what the right thing is for Jerry Tuchilli.
What about Brian Kemp?
That said, I recognize that there are coordination problems here. I recognize that infectious disease is a difficult case. I personally have already jumped ahead to the absolute hideous disaster that our upcoming vaccine fight is going to be. Like, I live in the future, man. And there we are already absolutely at each other's throats over vaccination. I think one way to answer this question for a libertarian, incidentally, is to think about the best that you can, a hypothetical of anarchy, to say, okay, if there is no government, how would people organize themselves in the face of this problem? And that is how you get to an answer about how onerous or how liberty violating certain rules are when they are imposed by the governments we actually have. So, for instance, we can say, well, if I am, you know, if I'm imagining what a stateless society would do about the vaccination problem or the mask problem, I can say, well, what's Walmart doing? Which is the closest thing we have to a government. In some places, maybe hypothetically, you can say, what are private schools doing? What are malls doing, right? And I think in our world, those entities are all acting within the constraints of governments. But I think it's pretty clear that lots and lots of entities would require people to be vaccinated or wear masks to participate in the services provided by that entity. And so for me, the answer to can we require children to be vaccinated to attend public school is, well, if there were no public schools, most schools would require children to be vaccinated to enter the school building. So that's a proxy for how we can think about how much of a violation a requirement is. Now, to me, that still means you have to leave leeway for private schools who want to opt out. You have to leave leeway for employers and retailers who want to opt out. But that's a long way around of saying, I want it as local as possible. I want it to look as much like my imagined anarchy as possible. And after that, oh my God, we're all going to murder each other over this again in the fall when we have a vaccine, God willing.
Peter, stepping away from the kind of mask, both culture war debate, because it is part of that and the politics of it, and then the sort of governor versus mayor element to this, which plays out in different directions in different states, including in New York, which has its own weird state governing structure. But there's been a lot of recent kind of lengthy TikToks about the Trump administration's response to coronavirus. I would, presuming that you've at least glanced at a few of them and are conversant on the topic, I would like you to drill down not on the economic, the stimulus kind of stuff, which, you know, Trump was talking about, payroll tax cut in his interview, but particularly things that the federal government can and should have done or do that that involves healthcare, stuff like testing, stuff like equipment and stuff. Where, in reading this and reading the discussions thereof, what could the administration have done or maybe might do better?
Without a doubt, the single biggest policy failure in all of this is the failure of the CDC to develop test kit, to develop a test kit in a timely manner, and the failure of the FDA to get that test kit approved, or to allow private companies that already had successful test kits in other countries to roll out their tests. And so the CDC and the FDA are kind of the foundation of America's policy failure here. And they lost us several months as the initial CDC test kit just didn't work. It had to be recalled like 3 or 4 weeks after it was put out. It was just a complete bureaucratic bumble on like every single level. And that's where things start. And that is the kind of mistake that I think probably, or at least likely, could have happened under any administration. It's not Trump specific. The CDC in particular has just been a kind of creaking agency that doesn't work super well. It works, you know, you can make an argument that some presidents run it a little better, some presidents run it a little worse, but it has had problems for at least a decade or two. And those were apparent. Plus, it's kind of general theory of the case. We should have one test kit. It should be developed by the federal government. And that creates a single point of failure. And when you create a single point of failure and it fails, everything goes very, very badly. And that's what we saw in February, March, and then through early April. A lot of the recent TikToks have focused on Trump's decision to allow governors to take the lead in the response. And I think there are some things to criticize there, but I also think a lot of the TikToks have gone overboard in criticizing a kind of federalist response. What Trump did wrong was that he both inadequately supported governors and forced them to compete against each other. What he didn't do wrong was allow them to try different things. And trying different things is what governors should be doing. What we want from governors is to be trying a bunch of different policy responses, in part because, as Catherine has said repeatedly, the virus isn't the same in every place. The outbreaks aren't the same in every place. They're not the same in every time. But Trump, because he's Donald Trump and because he's not a great administrator of things, I think, to put it mildly, basically made the governors compete against each other rather than just sort of give them the flexibility to figure out what they wanted to do. And that has proven a problem. Also has not put out the kind of guidance, but not mandate, that you would expect from the federal government in terms of exactly how to run testing on these sorts of thing on this thing, and how to kind of manage case flows. And the testing thing just continues to be a huge problem. I have a family member who works in relatively close proximity with a couple of colleagues, one of whom just found out in the last couple of days that this colleague of my family member tested positive for COVID. The test was on July 7th. It is this morning, July 20th. These tests are frequently taking 7 to 10 days to get your results back, to the point where they're almost useless. I mean, at that point, you either know that you are very sick, or you're probably not going to be all that sick. And 10 to 14 days later, you are unlikely to be particularly to spread it to other people. And so it's still a real mess. But again, that goes back in a lot of ways, not all, but in a lot of ways, to the initial failure by the CDC and by the FDA to get this stuff put together and rolled out quickly and to respond to the actual facts on the ground. The CDC followed their normal protocol on this when they were developing their test kit. And the normal protocol is we assume that this won't be a once in multiple generations pandemic. And in that case, you can make an argument. I'm not sure it's a great one, but you can at least make an argument that, hey, let's just have the CDC do it. And that way, we're not going to have a whole bunch of different test kits floating out there with different response and error rates. And we just know this one pretty much works this way and everybody uses it. That sort of makes sense, or at least you can make an argument for it in normal times. These were not normal times. And it was relatively obvious, at least to some policymakers and to some people sort of high up in the, you know, sort of health policy world as early as the first week of February when the CDC, was still messing around with this. You had Scott Gottlieb saying, guys, this is an easy thing. We know how to do. There are a bunch of private companies that are sitting around ready to do it. Just don't go through the normal protocol. This is a special case. And the federal government doesn't know how to deal with special cases and doesn't know how to respond to unique incidents. They run the playbook that they had. And in this case, they ran a bad playbook and they ran it badly. And it has produced disastrous results.
And I would add that the political and media culture doesn't generally know how or is express, demonstrate interest in having that kind of nuanced set of responsibility affixing that Peter Suderman just engaged in. It's amazing to see how many people on a daily basis try to sort, you know, Trump good, Trump bad, Cuomo good, Cuomo bad as the explanation for everything that has happened. When in fact, that's kind of not how things
work. Yeah, I would just add very quickly that anybody who is making the argument that the federal government should have stepped in to do more should look at the instances in which the federal government did take control of the situation in the past 6 months. Just about every time, it went very badly. And that doesn't mean that in some ideal hypothetical world in which the federal government is staffed with a whole bunch of really good, really smart, really competent people, you can't, in hindsight, kind of figure out how maybe it would have gone better if we'd had all those really good, really competent people in the federal government making things work from the top. But we don't have them. We clearly don't have them. And as a result, when you argue that the federal government should be doing more centrally, you are arguing that those people who are actually in power, that is President Donald Trump and the CDC, which has failed a bunch of times, that they should have taken more control. In fact, what's going on in Portland right now is the federal government taking more control. It is going real badly, guys.
Let's go to our end of a podcast cultural consumption segment. What are you consuming to tickle your brains? Catherine Mangue Ward, you go first.
I got a little bit late to the Hamilton on Disney Plus game, but have now caught up there. And I saw the show when it came to the Kennedy Center, but it's a delight to see it with the original cast. And that's been awesome. That has put me back on a musical kick. So I am now also really enjoying Hadestown, which is a musical that I had been dimly aware of. It's based on the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. And in my household, we are on a Greek myths binge and have been for a while. Read what you want into that about the fact that we're coping with coronavirus by like worshiping Artemis in our house at the moment. But Hadestown has a lot of the merits of Hamilton. It's a little bit modern, a little bit less of the schlockiness that puts some people off of musicals. Also, though, very freaking emo. So just like be aware that if you open this door, there will be like moping around about musical adaptations of dead Greek heroes. And you need to price that into your day.
Like skinny jeans and listening to Mineral albums from the mid-90s emo or?
Yeah, except Greek mythology, basically.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I reread Kindly Inquisitors, Jonathan Rauch's 1993 book about the function and need for free speech and open inquiry in a successful society. The 20th anniversary issue edition, which came out via Cato and University of Chicago Press in 2013, is a good place to start because it has a great intro from George Will and an afterword by Rauch himself. I interviewed him about the current moment about cancel culture. That'll be coming up on the Wednesday podcast. And the book is great because in a way it totally anticipates the current moment, which is simultaneously depressing and kind of heartening. part of what Roush talks about is that what we now call cancel culture, it takes different forms at different times, but it's always with us. And it's always incumbent upon those of us who believe in free speech and open inquiry and, you know, what Karl Popper would call an open society. We need to be, you know, we need to be defending that and making the case for it every damn day. So I highly recommend Kindly Inquisitors, the 20th anniversary edition.
It is the book that I recommend the most, I think, and has been for a while. Besides, of course, the Bible, Catherine. Suderman.
And Atlas Shrugged.
Nope.
But you repeat yourself.
Yeah. Wow. That's why they pay the big bucks. Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I watched the movie Mr. Jones. It's a late 2019 film about set in 1933, and it's about the real person, the Welsh journalist Gareth Jones, who travels to the Soviet Union and meets Walter Duranty, who is the New York Times correspondent, who just lied and lied and lied and won a Pulitzer for it, and lied and lied and lied some more in favor of the communist regime there. And Jones sort of sneaks away in order to go see the famine in the Ukraine and report on it. And he was instrumental in bringing the truth about the Ukraine famines and the failures of the collective farms under Stalin. It's a very well-made movie. It is sometimes actually somewhat difficult to watch. It is very Polish in that sense. It is by a Polish director. I'm probably going to mispronounce her name, but Agnieszka Holland, I believe, who is
that's pretty good.
Yeah. Who, if you have watched peak TV shows over the last 20 years, you have probably seen some of her work. She's directed episodes of The Wire, House of Cards, a bunch of other shows like that. But this movie is much more austere. It's much more sort of it's dark. It's depressing, and the scenes in Ukraine are just hard to watch. And in some ways, I almost wanted to come in and be like, no, you have to give people something to hang on to other than the sheer horror of it. At the same time, it's a 25-minute sequence that is just about the sheer horror of starving because your government makes you. And that's something you don't see in movies every day. It's a powerful and brutal look at the wages of communism and what happens when you come in and ruin an economy because of your political plans and your ideology.
How much of it is, if I may ask Peter, just to bring it to the current moment, how much of it is a critique of media and media being controlled by a few sources?
I would say that it's less overtly a critique of media in general, but it is a very, very harsh look at Duranty, who the movie ends with. I'm spoiling history here. The movie ends by describing briefly Jones's death when he is killed by a Soviet agent while he's on another reporting trip. He died at the age of 30, I believe. And then the final title card is just something like Walter Duranty died at the age of 77 in Florida. He still has a Pulitzer.
Ooh, my cultural consumption, like a lot of my life, was centered around my male menopause. The other night I was late night YouTube spelunking old Linda Ronstadt videos, which is as good as it gets, people.
God. You're no good, Matt Welch. You're no good. You're no good.
I came across a live performance of the Glenn Campbell show from 1970 of her singing Long, Long Time, which is really great. And then when I was listening to it, I was like, that reminds me of an artist who I kind of had like fell through my brain cracks. I hadn't thought about it in a really long time. Tom Waits. He has a song called Time. The structures of the song are kind of similar, and which led me to discovering that they toured together in the mid-70s, and oh my god, that would have been weird. And I went back and listened to what apparently was one of my favorite albums for a long time, but I hadn't listened to in 15 odd years, which is the album on which Time, if that is indeed the exact name of it, appears, which is Rain Dogs by Tom Waits. Can't recommend it highly enough, even if you are irritated by his vocal stylings and the sounds of people clanking on various pots in New Orleans basements and whatnot, which is just filled with it on this record, in addition to a little Keith Richards on the side. But it is so great, and it's such a great like masking exercise in the way that the album by Wilco, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, is as well, of like, there's so many great classic pop songs that they just try to subvert with lots of weirdo noises. But there are a lot of really great classic pop songs underneath it all. And wow, is it great. And I didn't realize at the time when I used to love it, how much of it was intended to be not just some kind of gutter bar New Orleans thing, but he was trying to describe mid-1980s New York, especially Lower East Side stuff. So that's re-interesting to me as someone who now understands that part of the world a little bit, tiny bit more. Basically, it's all Nick Gillespie's neighborhood now, as far as I could tell. But anyways, that's all the time we have for the Reason Podcast this week, a Reason Roundtable this week. Look, someone's got to do it. Go to reason.com podcasts. You can hear all our good stuff, including the interview with Nick Gillespie, Soho Forum series, Gene Epstein et al. And we'll catch you next week. Some of us will be going on vacation, daring the great American interiors to infect them with coronaviruses. But we're going to have a fun and engaging summer nonetheless. Goodbye.